Mark Thompson on Music Mill FM.
Hello, you're listening to the Music Mill. I'm Mark Thompson, here with you for the next hour or so. Now, normally I have two guests each week discussing two different subjects, but this week I'm going to do something a little bit different. As I'm sure you'll recall, in the run-up to last year's general election, the vast majority of pollsters and commentators thought it was almost impossible for the Conservatives to achieve a majority, but that is what happened. So, how did it come about? How could the polls have got it so wrong? Well, I'll be joined in a few minutes by Matt Singh of the website Number Cruncher Politics. Matt is one of the very, very few people who actually called the general election correctly and predicted a Tory majority. So I'll be talking about how he came to that conclusion and what everyone else did wrong. And yesterday, a report commissioned by the polling companies as a sort of post-mortem on the election polling was released. So we'll discuss that too. We'll also go into some of the detail relating to what is likely to happen in the future. Is political polling so badly damaged that it will never recover? And this is such a big subject and so topical that we thought it deserved the full hour this week. As I mentioned, we are going to be talking exclusively tonight about political polling, with a predominant focus upon what happened in the run-up to the general election last year, so general election 2015. I'm very pleased to be joined tonight by Matt Singh of Number Cruncher Politics, who holds the distinction of being one of the only people who actually managed to call the general election for the Conservatives as a majority government in advance of the general election. Obviously, after the general election, you know, everyone thinks, well, yeah, it was obvious, wasn't it? But it wasn't obvious at the time, was it, Matt? Good evening.
Good evening, Mark.
Yeah, well, first of all, congratulations on getting it right when everyone else got it so wrong. That must be a nice feeling for you.
It is. It's feeling, vindication, because obviously the sorts of analysis I was using was quite controversial, and it did raise a few eyebrows, I guess. So it's kind of good to have the for it to have worked out.
Yeah, I mean that was really the first thing I wanted to talk about. You wrote a blog post. I think it was on the 6th of May, so very shortly before the general election, entitled "Is There a Shy Tory Factor in 2015?" That was on Number Cruncher Politics.
Yeah.
And that was a pretty lengthy blog post. It's actually separated into about 10 different pages that you've kind of got to scroll through.
Yeah.
And I was actually, my attention was drawn to that by a chap called Sean Lawson, who I'd kind of been communicating with over Twitter for a few days. He'd written a blog post where he'd said he was starting to wonder if things were maybe going to go the Conservatives' way. Because of various things I was doing, I didn't really get the chance to read it until I started reading it at about 20 past 8 on election night evening, as I was in a hotel in Margate waiting for the results to come, and I finished it about 20 to 10. And at that point, your article was so persuasive that I just became convinced you were right. Yeah, everything you said just seemed to make sense. It seemed to fit. And I tweeted to that effect, and I suddenly got a load of people saying, what are you on about? What do you mean the Conservatives are going to win? Where are you getting that from? And of course, 20 minutes later, you were vindicated. So what... Can you talk me through the process of how you came to write the blog post and maybe some of the details in it for anyone who hasn't read it?
Sure. What I did basically was to take, instead of just looking at the top line numbers, the headline, the standard, who are you going to vote for question, I looked beyond that, so internal data within the current polls. So questions, the supplementary questions about what people think about the leaders and so on. And looking at the you know, the composition of the don't know, so they ask everybody, who did you vote for last time? So if you've got if the people saying don't know are particularly one way or the other, that can be an indication of shy Tories. They found after 1992, when they investigated, they found that people who had said don't know were disproportionately Tory in 87. So that was where the whole shy Tory thing came from. I did, in the title, I kind of used the word a bit lazily, and in hindsight, I probably should have just talked about polling error, because I was really seeing statistical patterns rather than actually the what was necessarily causing it. That was only something I've come on to later. But really, the patterns were in terms of things like the leader ratings, the local election results, and the where there's been by-elections and the European elections and so on. The polls were consistently getting the Labour-Tory gap wrong, often not by huge amounts, within the margins of error of individual polls, but they were consistently in the same direction, which is the sort of the traditional understating the Conservatives relative to Labour. So I went through and, as you mentioned, it was a very long, I think, 6,000-word piece. So I covered pretty much everything I could think of that might give some sort of steer as to which way the balance of risks lay in terms of the accuracy of the polls. And the crucial thing on last year was that it wasn't that it was one thing or a couple of things or even most things that were saying that the headline numbers were wrong and the Conservatives were going to win. It was that basically everything I could find to look at besides the top line numbers was pointing that way. So, I mean, it is kind of sort of psychologically difficult when you've been hearing this. You've been hearing this narrative for so long, as I had and everyone else had, that of what was going on. But I sort of, rather than trusting that, I sort of looked into the data, and it was clear from that the evidence was overwhelming that something was not right.
Obviously, you mentioned about you've kind of drilled down and you were noticing this, for want of a better phrase, shite-ory effect,
yeah.
Or maybe kind of slightly incorrect sampling effect.
Yeah.
What do you think that this? The reason why it wasn't picked up on is because it wasn't that big a gap, and it had never materially made that much difference, at least not since 1992. Which actually, I was going to mention 1992 a bit later on, but
sure.
Do you think that that's maybe why it sort of escaped attention, because it just hadn't really made the difference until 2015?
Yes, I mean, certainly a large part of it was that you'd had after 1992, so you'd had a couple of Labour landslides, and then a solid Labour majority, and then in 2010 you had something quite interesting, because the Conservatives were underestimated in the polls, as you know, by about the same amount that they typically had been. And the difference in 2010, when you had a close enough election, it was going to be a hung parliament, and it really mattered. You actually had Labour underestimated by about the same amount or slightly more, and the Lib Dems being hugely overestimated. And as a result of those two factors, the gap between Labour and the Conservatives had been called pretty much spot on. That number, as is now acknowledged, is the crucial thing under our electoral system to get the seats right. So the fact that the polls basically called the right result at that election, as they had at each of the elections before that, back in 1997, kind of took people's attention away from the fact that the polls had missed quite badly on the Lib Dems in 2010, and they had, even in the previous elections, unseen, because Labour were winning so comfortably, that the polls had been overestimating Labour and underestimating the Tories. And so there were signs, even in the historical patterns, that perhaps weren't picked up on to the extent that they might have been.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you've made there about the 2010 election, because I was going to ask you about that as well. I mean, of course, that was an incredibly close election in the end. Like you say, it led to a hung parliament. And yet it seems to be that, although mistakes were made, they were made in equal measure to both Conservatives and Labour. Actually, I was at Lib Dem back in 2010, so the fact that the Lib Dems appeared to have been overestimated was somewhat irksome to me. And I always sort of thought, I mean, I'm not a Lib Dem anymore, but I did always sort of think that what happened with the Lib Dems was slightly glossed over because they ended up in government, and therefore the whole narrative was, well, didn't the Lib Dems do well? They've ended up in government, even though effectively that was just a fluke of the way the numbers fell elsewhere, really. And actually, They got 23%, but some of the polls were saying they were going to get 28, 30, 32%, and they were way out, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember which debate it was between, but obviously, you know, once the Clegmania phenomenon took off, you got some very high numbers. I think there were six or seven polls that actually showed the Lib Dems leading. And obviously, they sort of subsided by the end. And so I think the average in the final polls was about 4 points too high on the Lib Dems. I think it was 23.6 was the actual mainland vote share, and then I think the polls had 27 or 28. So that was, you know, a reasonable size error. The thing that I think that confused people at the time was that obviously there'd been a huge surge in the Lib Dem support, on, you know, off the back of Clegmania and you know, Labour's unpopularity after the you know, after the election and so on. And I think a lot of people saw the errors in the polls: Lib Dems too high, Labour and Tories too low, and thought that it had maybe been something specific to the Lib Dems that had hurt Labour and the Tories in equal measure. It's looking back on it now, it's possible that it was actually more of a Lib Dem Labour thing. The Tories were just underestimated as usual, and it was a sort of it was an overestimation of the Lib Dems at the expense of Labour, who otherwise would have been overestimated. And I think the fact that 2010 was, in terms of, you know, getting the result right, they basically got the result right, and had been getting sort of, I mean, 2005 they did reasonably well. So the fact that it was getting progressively more accurate over various electoral cycles, and on top of that, the fact that the exit polls have been incredibly accurate, and obviously it's important to point out that exit polls and campaign polls are completely different animals, but it kind of fed into this idea that the problems that had happened in 1992 and, you know, elsewhere in the past had been fixed, and catastrophic polling errors just didn't happen anymore. So there was an overconfidence in the ability of the pollsters to get it right. Not necessarily from the pollsters themselves, but in general, I think there was even without having reasons to suspect it, that the polls were going to get it wrong in the way that they did, there were reasons to think maybe the chances of something going badly wrong were higher than had generally been acknowledged.
Yeah, I think the thing that struck me perhaps most about the piece that you wrote back in May is that you'd drilled down into all kinds of different data sets, by-elections, local elections, European elections, and you found the same pattern over and over again, that there was this slight, well, depending on how close the election was, I mean, it depends on what your definition of slight is, but a slight underestimation of the Tory vote pretty much consistently throughout the record over about 50 years worth of data. Why do you think that was just largely ignored by most of the people? You're not the only person that I heard say stuff like this, but it certainly wasn't given very wide coverage. Why do you think that was and is?
It's difficult to say, really. I mean, trying to think through to how other people would have viewed it. I mean, to me, it was. I wouldn't say that what I found was obvious, but it seemed like an obvious thing to try and investigate, because you had all of these really clever forecasts, you know, with, you know, very smart people with some very smart models and coming up with great ways of turning votes into seats and all of these fancy things and predicting stuff from way out. But the weak link in all of this was always going to be, is the underlying data that you're putting in actually right? I think there was a sort of a Steve Fisher from Oxford, who's also part of the exit poll team, the model that he'd done on elections, etc., was he's one of the models that actually did build in a specific variable for Tory outperformance relative to polls and Labour underperformance. which he got a, you know, he was kind of controversial, but ultimately vindicated. But most models were sort of, they'd taken the view that, you know, it just wasn't possible to predict in advance where the polls would get it wrong. So, I mean, well, for me that was a challenge, but people had sort of widely thought that, okay, it's this thing that's been going on, but we can't really be sure it's going to be that way this time, particularly after people pointed to 2010 and see that, the you know, for the first time on the spread, for the first time since 1983, they'd actually got it the other way. So I think it was kind of the perception that it was difficult to actually do anything about this in terms of predicting it, but also the fact that it may possibly have the problem may have sort of been fixed.
Yeah. I mean, we've sort of maybe covered this question already kind of implicitly through some of the stuff we just talked about, but
yeah.
Why do you think the other polls got it so wrong? I mean, do you think there are any other factors maybe we haven't touched upon?
In terms of the polling error, I mean, we know now from various work that's been done that the polls had unrepresentative samples. So they basically had a sample, 1,000 people, 2,000 people, whatever it is, that was systematically different from the electorate as a whole. And combined with that, the fact that the weighting techniques that have saved them on a number of occasions in the past and taking raw data that isn't necessarily representative, certainly isn't random, and making it into something that is sufficiently representative of the electorate in all of the respects that matter, in order to get a, you know, voting intention numbers that that give you the right result, for whatever reason, and I have some theories on this, but that wasn't effective in fixing the problem. And you know, I mean, the problem was quite severe in terms of the raw data, because interesting side of the inquiry yesterday was that. That the raw data basically showed sort of, you know, 15,200 people one way and 15,300 people the other way. I mean, it was literally neck and neck. So the weighting procedures and all of the adjustments that they've come up with since, or came up with, you know, in the 90s have sort of, and refined over the years, obviously, were just not able to adjust for the bias in the raw data. I mean, there were other sorts of things that have been talked about. So obviously, one big thing that came up afterwards, in the light of the fact that everyone was talking about you know, huge turnouts, and in the end, turnout was up 1 point, which was almost entirely accountable by Scotland. So the question then was, is there a sort of so-called lazy Labour factor? Are Labour voters telling pollsters they're going to vote and then actually not voting at all? It turns out that wasn't really the case. They'd gone back and looked at the marked registers, and so they can actually see who's actually voted, and compare it to the people that have in the sample. And it turns out that there was basically no difference between the parties on that. Late swing, people changing their minds at the last minute. The evidence for that is inconsistent between pollsters, but if it did happen, it was very small. And the sort of the classic shy Tories, don't knows that do know. The evidence for that again is mixed. Seems to be different between phone and online, but even if it was there, the effect of that was very small. You can sort of account for nearly all the difference with this sample bias that they seem to have uncovered, partly from going through the pollsters data, but then also these very high quality, not to mention very expensive and very slow probability surveys that were done over the summer by the BES and the BSA that basically got the results about right. Obviously, there are some people a few months afterwards, so you know that you have to factor in people possibly not remembering correctly how they voted, but all of the evidence points strongly towards the samples simply not being representative in the polls.
Yeah. You mentioned the review that reported yesterday, and I'm sure you know you've been kind of involved in talking about that and covering that. Was there any? I haven't had a chance to really look at the details of it. Was there any mention made of kind of herding problem to do with polling companies kind of converging around the same result because no one wants to be the an outlier that's too far away from the core consensus for fear of looking stupid? Because some polls did predict it correctly, but I read in some cases some of the by the time the data was published, it had been massaged in such a way as to kind of conform more closely to what the consensus was saying, and therefore it didn't really come through. Was there any mention of that?
Well, there was, I mean, there was one documented case that we're aware of with Servation where they had a telephone poll that was showed, I think it was a 6-point Conservative lead, and for various reasons which they've written about, they decided not to, to publish it. But in general, there isn't a lot of the conducting a poll and not publishing it for the simple reason that it costs money to do, and it's generally done for, you know, done for a client who would want it to, who would want it published. In terms of the, you know, the vast bulk of them that were published, the issue of herding was raised. It was one of, you know, within the terms of reference of the inquiry, is something that they needed to look at, and they did look at it, and they were unable to rule out herding happening. But it, I mean, it's the. The reporting on this has been, in some cases, a little bit misleading because there was no suggestion in the inquiry that it was actually a cause of the polls getting it wrong. It was actually, one thing that came out of the inquiry briefing was actually that as a result of the methodological changes that pollsters made late on, they actually got closer to the result than they would have otherwise by a small amount. So it's something that's being investigated because obviously it's not the kind of thing that you want happening in a polling industry, and it's something that, you know, in some cases, in the cases in the US where it looks as though herding exactly caused the polls to get it wrong, there's no real evidence, they say, that it happened this time. In terms of causing the failure, so it's sort of it's something to be investigated, but it's not something that they're saying is possibly a cause of the errors.
Okay, I mean it's easy to kind of bash the pollsters, as you know, I've heard lots of people since the election basically question what's the point of having polls at all, and there's been talk about banning them during the run-up to election campaigns and that they distorted the narrative. I mean, actually, just on that point, do you think they did distort the narrative? Do you think that if the polls had been reflecting what actually happened in the end, that the narrative of the general election campaign might have been quite different?
I imagine the narrative would have been quite different, but the question then is what effect, if any, would it have had on the results? And there's two schools of thought on the sort of the feedback loop between polls and results via the media and the narrative. I mean, on the one hand, there's the sort of fear factor. So so in this case, it would have been the Conservatives that shown to be close to that, you know, maybe motivate more Conservatives to come out and vote, or may have, you know, get people talking about the, you know, the SNP and things like that. On the other hand, you've got the sort of this momentum theory, which if the polls had been right and shown the Conservatives in the lead, or at some point they would have been pulling ahead into the lead, the narrative is then the Conservatives are doing well, and Labour dropping behind, Labour losing. So you can sort of get this bandwagon effect in theory. It's quite hard to analyse because the only time you can ever check whether a poll is right is an election result. So when you're talking about polls being wrong and polls moving in a certain way and then affecting the narrative, there's no real way of analysing what would have happened in the in the alternate scenario.
Yeah, so, I suppose you can never run a counterfactual, can you?
No, exactly.
Unfortunately, there are some situations I'd love to be able to do that, but
yes.
So, like I said, sort of, you know, lots of people have bashed the polling companies, but I mean, I think it's a fair question to ask: what did they get right? Because they did get quite a lot of stuff right. In fact, almost apart from the headline figures of the vote share of the parties, most of the underlying data they did get right, didn't they? Things like who do you want, you know, who would you most like to see as prime minister? Who can you trust most with the economy? Questions like that. They were all pointing to a Conservative victory, weren't they?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, in a way, it's interesting to consider how, given that there were clearly samples that were not representative and were producing headline numbers that were clearly wrong, how those samples were able to produce responses to the other questions, particularly the leadership, because one of the things I illustrated in that article was that there's a very close relationship between people's perceptions of the leaders and how they actually vote, and it fits almost perfectly this time, but based on headline number. So that is actually, you know, a bit of a puzzle. It's possible that you know, if the sample was too partisan, you were getting people who may have had similar views on the leaders to the electorate as a whole, but because they were partisan, they were voting for their side in spite of what they thought of the leader, or, you know, not voting the other side in spite of having a positive view of the other side, the leader. So that's only a theory. I don't really have anything to back that up. But in terms of the things they demonstrably got right, you can certainly see that in Scotland, whether it's based on the, you know, the Scottish subsample or the actual Scotland polls, was extremely accurate. I think all of the polls during the campaign had the SNP between 46 and 54%, and they got 50%. And the final polls, you averaged them up, and they were pretty much spot on. So they were right on that. And then even in the Great Britain-wide polling, they got the Lib Dem national share right. There was a difference between pollsters on UKIP, but the average of them was absolutely spot on, which is no mean feat when a party's quadrupled its vote share from the last election. So that was quite impressive. They got that right. Exactly the same situation with the Greens, which they got slightly high, but basically right. And so it was really the Labour Tory combined, or sorry, the Labour Tory gap was pretty much the in England and Wales was really the part that it was really the exception. It just happened that was the most important number in the polls.
Yeah. Okay, we're just going to take a break and put a record on for a couple of minutes, I think, just to both allow us both to take a bit of a breather. When we come back, we're going to talk about maybe what the future holds for polling, and also perhaps one or two other things that have either been polled recently, like Labour leadership contest, and also maybe thinking about the EU referendum and perhaps what lessons we can apply from the mistakes that have been made previously to that. Just before I do put the record on, though, I just wanted to ask you one other question related to this, Matt.
Yep.
Did you put any money on a Conservative victory? Because you would have got very good odds.
There were various ways that you could express a view that the Conservatives were going to do a lot better at the polls. So I bet on it in various ways.
Good
one
news.
Of which was actually betting on a Conservative majority.
Wow, what odds did you get?
It was sort of done at various points at different. At different odds. I can't remember exactly what the average was, but it was good odds.
I like to hear a man who puts his money where his mouth is. Okay, well, we'll be back in a few minutes with Matt Singh of Number Cruncher Politics.
Mark Thompson on Music Mill FM.
Yes, Mark Thompson on Music Mill FM here with you for about the next 20 minutes or so. We're talking to Matt Singh, who is a statistician and who writes for Number Cruncher Politics, who's one of the very few people who predicted the correct outcome of the general election last year, and who we've just discovered actually put some money on that outcome as well, so managed to make some money out of it too, which is great news. Matt, I just wanted to talk about what the future might hold for polling now, because there's obviously been a lot of talk since the election about what went wrong, and then there's been the review, as we've talked about, that reported yesterday. Do you think polling can recover from this? And do you think it will be taken seriously in future elections?
Well, I think in order for it to recover in terms of credibility, it has to, the pollsters have to put in good performance in the various tests that they've got coming up. So you've got devolved elections in Scotland and Wales, which are the most, if you can call them any election straightforward, they're the most straightforward to poll because they happen every 5 years, and then you've got pass vote weighting and all those sort of things as benchmarks. And then also London, which is a very difficult contest to poll for all sorts of reasons. And because it looks as though it's reasonably close, that could be a particular challenge. And then, of course, the EU referendum, which is the one that's going to get the most attention, certainly internationally, and I imagine it would be the main thing here. That is highly non-standard because it's a unique event. The one in 1975 won't tell you anything about polling for this time. So there are a number of tests coming up in a pretty short space of time, and I think for the way for polling in Britain to recover its credibility needs to get a lot of those needs to be seen to be putting in a big, good performance in those tests. As far as the international picture goes, there have obviously been a number of other issues in countries around the world, and I think to some extent pollsters are having the same sorts of difficulties in different countries. So things need to be done in order to get it right, basically, and then once that's been done, they can rebuild the reputation.
I mean, do you think we, and by we I mean kind of the media, but by extension the public as well, because it's the public clamour for information that prompts the media to do it the way it does do it, do you think that we use polling in the wrong way, or in fact maybe abuse polling? Because it's by nature a snapshot of opinion, and there is always a margin of error of 3% anyway.
Yep.
And yet, what you'll see in the run-up to an election, and I'm pretty sure we will see this in the run-up to, say, the EU referendum, as you've just been talking about, albeit it might be tinged with a little bit of, or maybe a lot of scepticism about whether to believe the polls or not, but they'll still be published, and they'll probably be published very frequently. I mean, in the run-up to the general election, we were getting multiple polls every single day, and yep, any little shift in, a percentage point here, a percentage point there, was leapt upon as a Labour surge or a Tory surge, when actually all of those supposed surges, or most of them, could have just been explained by the margin of error. And it seems like that just sort of gets ignored, and whatever narrative the newspaper or the media organisation wants to push just gets kind of hung off the back of these polls. Do you think we as a society need to be more mature about how we look at polls and accept that they're not necessarily going to be absolutely bang on, and if you want frequent polls and multiple polls every single day, the money just isn't there for them to be as accurate as they would need them to be absolutely spot on?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer to that is yes. The way polls were reported in the run-up to the election and since, and for a long time in the past, has been quite variable from very good to very bad, even within the same sort of organisation or the same paper. But I mean, to speak to it broadly, I think we've gone from one extreme to the other, whereby there was, as I was pointing to earlier, there was a sort of complacency, and now we've gone to the other extreme, which is the sort of the complete and undue, in a lot of cases, scepticism. I think, as you're sort of suggesting, the happy medium is a sort of a mature, healthy scepticism about polling accuracy and an understanding of the limits of what polling can do, but combined with a recognition that it, that it points, provides a very useful snapshot and measure of public opinion. And I think it's been quite, I think to give a few examples of where polling has proved its use. I mean, we only need to look at the Oldham by-election, where there was no polling and it was simply going by straws in the wind, and basically even the campaigns were convinced that it was very, very close, and it ended up being a pretty, I think, 39-point winning margin for Labour.
See, that you've identified a very important point here, that people can complain about polls till they're blue in the face, but actually they're the best we've got, because, like you say, if in the absence of polling, I mean, maybe the Oldham by-election there is almost a kind of microcosm of what you might see nationwide if, say, polling 3 months before a general election was banned in this country, in that you're just going to get people going on gut feel, canvassers reporting back what they reckon they've heard on the doorstep, and people just using conventional wisdom and common sense to determine what's going to happen, and that surely would be much worse than polls, however whatever accuracy problems they might have, are striving to get a decent sample, and even in the final analysis we're only a few percentage points out, whereas, as you say, in Oldham whatever methodologies were or weren't used, it was miles out.
I mean, the polling methodologies we do at polling, in public at least, just wasn't used. All of that was going by gut feel. And, I mean, you can point to all sorts of other examples. I mean, there was a huge amount of scepticism about Jeremy Corbyn until even after the first YouGov poll came out. And when the second YouGov poll came out, then I think people, started to come around to the idea, okay, Corbyn might actually do it. And, great job by Lawrence Chancellor-Lipinski and everyone at YouGov for actually, nailing that poll. But then there were other things, like, for example, the SNP surge. Everyone was saying, they can't possibly get these kind of numbers and they can't win in these sorts of seats. And yet the polls there turned out to be spot on. And, I mean, you can point to all sorts of other cases where the people's gut feel has been wrong and the polls have been right. It's just because you had such a high-profile polling failure that people then not think, if we listened to our guts about this, we'd have got it right. But there would also have been plenty of times where, and possibly more times, when it would not have been right. So I think the polls, combined with scientific analysis of them and just a sort of a healthy dose of scepticism, is really the way that we have to look at elections and referendums and so on. I mean, sort of to quote what Patrick Sturdy said at the Inquiry yesterday, they're sort of in the Churchillian sense, they're the worst way of doing it apart from all the alternatives. So
that quote gets adapted to all kinds of things, but
I think it's spot on in this case.
I think you're right. I think it is quite apt. I mean, I don't want to single Ian Dale out for this, because lots and lots of people have done things like this, and I'm sure I've done it myself. I write a blog, and I'm sure I've used my gut feel to make predictions about things that have then turned out to be absolutely wrong. But I know that Ian Dale himself, he, for anyone who doesn't know, he he used to be a Conservative candidate. He's now a presenter on radio station LBC. He regularly tries to make predictions about things. And he actually painstakingly went through every single constituency in the run-up to the 2015 general election. And he tried to determine what the result would be in each seat, and he fully admitted he was going on gut feel. I think he was also slightly basing things on the Ashcroft polling too, in the marginal seats. But I raise it because you mentioned about the SNP, and he was way out with the SNP, and he's admitted subsequently it was just purely because, even though the polls were saying that actually the SNP could pretty much sweep the board and get 50 plus seats, he just couldn't imagine it happening. Because it had not happened before, he just couldn't imagine Labour suffering such a huge rout in Scotland. It just didn't compute to him, and therefore his prediction was, I think, for the SNP to get about 20 odd seats, when, of course, as we know, they got 56 seats. So the idea that gut feel can trump, you know, statistical analysis and polling and all the rest of it, it doesn't stand up to scrutiny, really. And I think there's quite a lot of kind of post hoc stuff going on that people, you know, can say, oh, well, yeah, I suspected that was going to happen. I've talked to people who aren't involved in politics, and they've said, oh, I knew that the Tories were going to win, but actually, I don't think most people did know that the Tories were going to win. I think it came as quite a surprise to almost everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I there was a lot, I think, of this sort of gut feel talk going around, and the way I approach it is, if you know, I sort of my gut feel says something that's different from what the numbers are saying, then you go and investigate the numbers and try and be scientific about it, and then try and get to the bottom. I mean, sometimes it isn't, you know, the data just doesn't exist in order to model something as accurately as you like. But I think one thing, I mean, I think this goes back to also to the 2012 election in the US, where, you know, there were lots of people saying, you know, their gut feel was that pollsters were oversampling Democrats, for example. And so, my take is that if you're going to say that the polls are wrong, you sort of have to back it up by analysis. So it's kind of, I think there is, it makes interesting discussion, talk about gut feel, but in terms of actually making predictions, I think, as you know, rightly suggest, is dangerous. I do draw the line between make the distinction between gut feel on something objective and where you have to make judgment calls, because sometimes there's no single right answer and you have to make a judgment call. I think that's quite different. But the idea that gut feel can trump polls, as you say, is dangerous, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you an example of where a gut feel of mine won me a little bit of money about 15 years ago. So this is slightly goes against what we were just talking about. But I had a bet with a friend of mine who was absolutely convinced that Michael Portillo was going to become leader of the Conservative Party in 2001. Mm. And because news had come out about some kind of bisexual, homosexual dalliances that he'd had in his youth around about the time that I was making the bet with my friend, I just went on gut feel that I just didn't think that the Tory membership was ready to elect someone who had publicly admitted to something like that. Now, maybe things might be different now, but this was 15 years ago. And so I bet my friend I didn't think Michael Portillo would win, and I was right about that, and that was just based on gut feel. So I guess sometimes gut feel, you know, because maybe it's a bit more than gut feel, it's more a kind of reading and understanding of an electorate and how they're likely to respond to certain information. But but most of the time I would take hard data over anecdote any day.
That's exactly the sort of the exception that I'm talking about, because in that case you don't really have the hard data, so you have to sort of base it on a judgment of, in this case, the Tory party, you know, the parliamentary party or the membership or whatever. So I don't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah. Just before we finish, I just wanted to briefly focus on the e-referendum. Obviously, you mentioned it yourself there, but that is probably the biggest the biggest event in politics that's likely to happen in the next few years, really. What do you think are the risks for the pollsters in the EU referendum? Obviously, you've mentioned it is a one-off and there's not that much that they can draw upon. But what do you think are the biggest risks for them getting it wrong and how to kind of mitigate against them?
I think the most obvious risk is that they aren't able to fix the problems with the representativeness of the samples, given that that is, you know, it's very clear that that's what caught them out last year, and they've only got a limited amount of time to be able to either fix it, so in terms of getting representative raw samples, or if they can't do that, then correct for it through weighting. And it's even more important here than in a general election, because you don't have, in a general election, you can weight by pass vote or party ID. This time you've got, you haven't sort of got anything where that acts as a sort of a the belt and braces, if you like, to hold the numbers in line. If you've got a badly unrepresentative sample, it could be they could end up being way off. And I think that's to a large extent reflected in the substantially different numbers that different pollsters are getting at the moment. They can't all be right. So I think that's the biggest single risk. But all of the usual things that you talk about in terms of risk to polling accuracy are going to be there. I mean, they don't know who's going to vote. They don't know, you know, how. They don't know for certain. I mean, people have. It's widely thought that in this kind of situation that the undecideds break for the status quo. But you know, they don't know for certain how undecided voters are going to go. So you might get a late swing. Are people being completely honest with pollsters? You know, we don't know. So all of the things, all of the usual risks are there, and then on top of it, you get this. You've got this problem that Europe in itself is not a particularly salient issue normally. Immigration is a very salient issue, and obviously you can make the case logically that it's tied up with that. But Europe on its own isn't a particularly, you know, it's not the talk of the town. So you've got that to consider in terms of, is the campaign going to change anything? So you've got all of the usual risks. So it is quite it's quite a nervy time for the pollsters, I think.
Yeah, indeed. I wouldn't like to be a pollster over the next few months, I have to say. Matt, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thanks very much for your time and for staying on for the full show. Like I said in the introduction, we've not done this before. We've always had two guests on and kind of split it into two halves. But I did think this was such an important topic, and one that is obviously very topical as well, given the review yesterday and the work that you've done on it, that it was important to have a good run at it. So thank you very much for your time.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
How can people get hold of you, social media and the website and so forth?
The easiest way is on Twitter. I mean, the website is ncpolitics.uk. So NC for number cruncher, politics.uk.
Or if they just put number cruncher politics into Google, it's the top result, isn't it?
Yeah, and then all the links to all of the social media. There's a number crunch Twitter account, and then I have my own Twitter account. That's all on there.
Great stuff. Okay, well, like I say, thanks for coming on, and good luck with all your future predictions and your betting on your future predictions as well.
Great, thank you very much.
Good stuff. Okay, so that's Matt Singh of Number Cruncher Politics talking to us about polling and the general election. Okay, so you've been listening to Mark Thompson on the Music Mill. My guest tonight was Matt Singh, and we've been talking about polling and the general election and all issues related to that. Next week, we're going to have Karen Lindsay, who is editor of Lib Dem Voice. She's going to be talking about the Lib Dems and how they're hoping to recover in the coming elections and over the next few years. And also, I'm going to be talking to Professor Franz Buscher, who is going to be talking about social mobility, but a particular aspect of social mobility that sometimes gets ignored, which is that in order for people to move up in the social strata. Some people who are currently occupying higher positions have to move down, and like I say, that's an aspect that often gets glossed over. So we're going to be drilling into some of the detail about that.
Let your words soothe you. Let your words see you through.